interesting fact that I can tell you. For better or for worse. We are on Daf Kaf Bet Amud Aleph, the very end of the page. That's 22A3 in the Shabbos Bible. Just a housekeeping question which Jay raised with me the other day. This is now the 6th, next week is the 13th, the week after that is the 20th, the 27th. I'm going to be away on the 27th, and Jay said something like we usually have it we miss 2 weeks. I'm going to be here on the 20th, so I'm perfectly happy to have class on the 20th, unless nobody else is going to be here. How about you guys? Are you around on December 20th? Yeah, it's a Wednesday, right. It would be like between Christmas and New Year's, but I'll be here before. Okay, so we will have class then on the 20th. Okay?
On the 27th
too? No, not on the 27th.
Skipping only the 27th?
Only the 27th.
Okay.
Only the 27th. Yeah. Okay.
So only the 27th is
normal.
Okay. I expected that you would.
No.
Okay. All right. Now, the Gemara that we are about to read in some editions is introduced by a Tanur Rabanan. Tanur Rabanan is a Baraita, and it's a long Baraita, which covers a wide variety of material with also a significant number of interpolations. Most of it is pretty clear, although the language is a little bit odd. You'll see the numerous parts in this Baraita, and I don't really have a good explanation for that. It begins as follows. This is the left side of 27A3, toward the bottom. Al kol hametim kulam, madchem mitato, areze meshubach. Al aviv va'al imo, areze megune. Okay? Now, we'll try to translate it. For all of the dead, kulam, all of them, meaning all of those people that you are required to mourn for. We can't find it. 22A3. Left-hand side, last two lines. All right? For all of the deceased that you are required to mourn for, manchem mitzatav areze meshubach. If you hurry up the mitah, the mitah there means what we call aron. Mitah is the bier or the casket. If you hurry up with the burial, if you move along the burial quickly, areze meshubach. This is praiseworthy. Al aviv al imo areze megune. But for his father and his mother, it is bad. Megune. It is uncomely. Okay? Now, let's take a look here at the commentaries. Let's see. 24, if you look down at 24, where the English commentary comments on the issue here. Well, let's look at 23. The other members of the family, it says, since it is not usual to mourn for or eulogize them so much, it is preferable to bury them quickly. And this is more of an honor to them than to have their bodies wait for burial without eulogies taking place during the waiting period. Now, assuming that that's a correct interpretation, and let's just assume that for a moment. What this means is that there were different ways of giving eulogies. Now, just keep in mind that our practice of having the chapel service certainly did exist then. That's a relatively new patent. Most places still in the world, you don't have anything like that. The Israelis have no funeral chapels. The Europeans, the South Americans, they don't have things like that. They have, at the cemetery, there's usually something that can be called a chapel, or a place at the cemetery, something like that.
Entrance to the sha'ar.
Right, that the sha'ar, the entrance to the cemetery, something like that you will find today. What actually exists in the ancient world, a little hard to know, but maybe we can learn a little bit from this. That in fact, the process of eulogizing was done then and there. It was probably done on the cemetery, and maybe even as part of the processional. So that if you have a processional, and you walk a certain amount of distance, you stop. Somebody gets up and says something. Then you walk a little further. You stop. Somebody gets up, says something. More or less, that's what these commentators are assuming was probably the procedure then. Okay? So, that process seems both good and bad. The good side of it is that it's nice to eulogize people. The bad side of it is that it takes time. It takes time. And so you can see that there's a tension here in the Baraita between two values. One value is the value of the eulogy. The other value is the value of the speedy burial. And here you can see that those two values are weighed together. And where it is for somebody who is not a parent, then the speedy burial wins out. When it is for somebody who is a parent, then the value of the eulogy wins out. Okay? So, in a way, this is reflecting that reality. You have to keep that in mind. Any questions here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In those days, where did they do the tahara? I'm asking because I once saw it done at the cemetery.
In those days, my assumption is that they did not do tahara. Tahara is the washing of the body, the literal washing of the body. As far as I can see, I don't know of any source that speaks about tahara before the beginning of the 17th century. 17th century. So that is approximately 1,500 years after what we have just read.
They send a tank into Europe.
Okay? For whatever reason, I don't think that's the reason for it. I think the reason has to do with the Kabbalah. It has to do with the Kabbalah of Tzfat and the way in which the Kabbalistic teachers of Tzfat finally made their ways into the European continent. That too I can't prove, but that's what the evidence seems to support. But in their time, I know of no evidence that they did anything like what we do called tahara. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah.
The presumption here, if it isn't for a parent, but you're responsible for organizing the funeral, the presumption, I guess, is that there isn't a child of the deceased. But for the sake of Kavod HaMet, with the fact that there isn't Jewish Hanukkah, it's sort of bothering you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I agree. And it may be that what we have just read shouldn't be taken on its own, but it's perhaps an introduction to the next things that are going to be said, because there are now going to be some circumstances which are more logical circumstances. And maybe something like that is what's being implied here. But indeed, we haven't seen anything that clearly addresses the value of eulogizing the deceased. We assume that that's a value. And it appears to be an implicit value when mention is made of the parents. Okay? So it's not, I agree with you, it's not all that clear. It makes you wonder a little bit. Now, I think also the language is odd. For those of you who speak Hebrew, how would you have translated Manche Mitzato HaRezim Mishamah?
Manche is the chot, is to postpone it a bit.
So look at this translation. It says, if one expedites, tell me what's the relation between the word postpone and the word expedite.
They're
exact opposite. Yes. So I think there's more problems to this text than is on the surface here. Because this use of the term manche, it means, to translate it this way, expedite is vinchot is to push. Right? Vinchot can be to push off, or to push away, ladchot, to cause the push. It is possible that it means what they said it means.
Maybe they mean lidchot, or maybe to push it toward the barrier. Maybe, even though lidchot, matche is lidchot, we usually talk about time to do it slower.
Uh-huh.
But here maybe they mean
that's what
to push it forward.
That's what the commentators are in fact saying. What is he saying?
Speedy,
make it speedy. Well, let's take a look at the Rashi. Remember that Rashi, the useful Rashi, well, there are two Rashis. First of all, look at the Rashi which is in the place where Rashi usually is. Remember that that's now on the inner margin. Here you've got it two lines up. Those of you who are not used to this, this is your Rashi. It's right over here. Right over here. And two lines up from the Rashi, it says, Manche mitato. Okay, Rashi explains, Nimaher lahotzio, right? He expedites, that's to lahotzio, to take him out, it really means to put him in. It's to take him out of where he was in order to put him into where he's going. Okay? So, remember, that's not Rashi. That's in the place of Rashi, but in this particular Masechet, that is probably Rabbeinu Gershom or Galah. Rashi that we have from the manuscript is now on the very small writing, the lower part of the page on the inside border. If you look down to the bottom of that, the very last line on the page, Manche mitato, Nimaher libor et meto ve'eno mashe'oto. Well, that's very clear. He hurries up to bury his dead and does not cause him to tarry. Does not cause him to tarry. Okay? So that seems to be what's being spoken about here. Haya Erev Shabbat. I'm going back into the text now. If it was the eve of the Sabbath, O Erev Yom Tov, or the eve of the Yom Tov, Harei Zeh Meshubach. It is not wrong to hurry up the burial of one's parent, but it's right to hurry up that burial. Okay? Harei Zeh Meshubach. She'eino oseh ela lichvod aviv imo. Because he does it solely for the purpose of the honor of his father and his mother. Okay? So we are saying, therefore, that the hurrying in and of itself is not a bad thing. It depends on the purpose of it. If it's interfering with the proper eulogizing, then it's not a good thing. If before the holiday begins or it's raining, in that way, in most cases, if you go too slowly, you won't be able to do it. If you don't do it then, you have to wait till after the holiday is over, or after the Sabbath is over. So then you really cause tremendous tarrying of the mint, and you don't want that to happen, and that's not nice to do for a parent. So in that case, in fact, it's the opposite. Okay? That you could hurry it along, and it's deemed to be praiseworthy. Okay? Al kol hametim kulam. For all of the deceased, ratzam ema'et be'isko, no. If he wishes, he may lessen his business activity. If he wishes, he may not. Okay, next page. Eno bimatri. He does, he may not. Al abi va'al imo bimait. But for his father and his mother, he certainly has to restrict his business activity. Okay. Now, I hope you remember what we had to say about this last year. If you don't, I'll remind you. We learned last year that when you are a mourner, or one of the obligatory parties for whom you must mourn, you must also not conduct your business. Here, too, you see that this baraita is a little bit weird. A little bit weird. It says something contrary to what we already learned before. And it's not, in all truth, it's not dealt with. It's taken out of context. Some of the things that come later on, as I said, the long baraita, some of the things that come later on are probably more why it's put in this particular place in the text. But it has these odd other things in it. And in fact, this is not what we do. It's not what we do. This is saying, though, that you have choice. If you're mourning for everybody other than your father and your mother, if you want to work, you can work. If you don't want to work, you don't have to work. And it depends on your own volition. But for the parent, it doesn't depend. The parent, you must cease your business activity.
Okay. Even if you're poor, completely poor.
Oh, so, of course. What? Okay, let's read number one. Read number one here. We learned above 15b 21a that a mourner is forbidden to do work during Shiva. Okay? So that was clear. How is this to be reconciled with our Baraita, which states that a mourner, except in the case of one's father or mother, may engage in business? Rashi's view, as explained by Tosafot, so it is that this Baraita is speaking of working to forestall a loss. That is to say, you may be in a business position where if you don't work, there's going to be a very significant loss. And a loss means not a small loss, but a big loss. Okay? So that, now this is the reason the later commentators, this is Rashi according to the Tosafot, which is already known in the 12th century. 12th century says, how could you have these two different points of view? Oh, they're talking about two different things. Two different situations. The one situation is where you're not going to suffer a loss, you know, where it's reasonable, you do your work, and it doesn't have any major implications on your business. The other, what we're reading about here, is where, in fact, you are in danger of suffering a major loss, okay? Then, if you are mourning for anybody other than your parents, you can work. If it's for the parents, for parents, you suffer loss, okay? We don't say you have to suffer loss for others. So, in fact, what we begin to see now is that when baraitot are not resolved, contradictions between baraitot are not resolved in the Gemara, which in fact in this case it is not resolved, doesn't make any difference. The people who come after the Gemara, they resolve it. Because they will then say, well, one must be in one case, another case. We just have to define what the two cases are. Okay? So that's one possibility. Such work is permitted to a mourner during Shiva unless he is mourning his father's mother. That's what we said. Other Rishonim. Now, Rishonim is referring to contemporaries, more or less contemporaries of Rashi. Rishonim means commentators on the Talmud before the time of the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, the Shulchan Aruch is roughly 1550 CE. 1550. Before that, you have Rishonim. The commentators after that are called Acharonim. Rishonim, earlier ones. Acharonim, later ones. But early and late is defined by the Shulchan Aruch, 1550. Okay? So here you have other Rishonim. Explain that it is only physical work that is forbidden during Shiva, but commercial dealings are permitted. That's a big opening. It must have been at a time when the Jews had moved into commercial and no longer were doing physical labor. Okay. Other Rishonim, see toward the end there, explain that our baraita refers to the period after the week of Shiva. But also a possibility, you could say, this is simply not talking about Shiva. Right, it's talking about the time after Shiva. We're talking about Shloshim. Okay, this is talking about Shloshim. But this is an extension for parents. You can't work even during the 30-day period of time. And all of these interpretations are possible because the text doesn't really help you. It doesn't give you any clarification. want to just for a moment read to you the summary of the law here. Earlier, last year, I read to you the summary of the law about working during the Shiva that was in the Lalam's book. And those of you who are here will perhaps remember that it was just all over the place. And it is all over the place. The law is not clear. The law is, there's a preference of the law, but there are lots of exceptions to it. And part of that is because the Talmud is so unclear. Once the Talmud is unclear, then you have a fair amount of maneuverability. Of course, if we're in the modern world, even if the Torah is clear, nothing is clear. It's assumed that everything has maneuverability. But in that world, they at least they felt somewhat constricted. This is now Rabbi Abner Weiss's book, Death and Bereavement, a Halachic God. One may not pursue one's business, trade, occupation, or profession during Shiva. One may not even appoint agents to do so on one's behalf. Household chores like sweeping the floor are permissible. Two, if at all possible, one's business should be closed for at least the first 3 days of Shiva. If this will involve one in significant, irreparable financial loss, okay, so here we have a financial loss issue, but it's put off now to the fourth day of Shiva. The fourth day of Shiva, because elsewhere we learn that the first 3 days are the significant days. One's business, if this will involve one of significant irreparable financial loss, one's business should have been sold during the Aninut period. The way you do it is that you sell your business.
You sell your law.
Okay? Not you don't sell your law, but you sell your business.
Like the
Chametz. Okay? Like the Chametz, exactly. All right? As we have said. Should it not be possible to sell one's business? And should one also be liable to pay the salaries of employees when they keep it open and retain the profits? Okay, so in here it gets very liberal. Here it gets very, very liberal. If one's business is such that it cannot be sold, one can conduct it even oneself, even during the first 3 days, so as to avoid an irreparable and significant loss. Okay?
If it's a constructive sale, they can even buy it back.
Yes, definitely. Yep. Yep. Three, if one is contracted to perform some work and a delay may cause great financial loss, the work may be subcontracted to others. Four, if a contractor arranged to work for a mourner before his or her near one passed away, the contracted job may be completed. This rule applies if the work is not being done in the Shiva house, and if it is not apparent to casual observers that the work is being done for the mourner. There's all kinds of permutations on this. If others will suffer irreparable loss through the mourner's cessation of work, that work may be done by him, even if he is the only ritual slaughterer or scribe for gittin in town, for example. Right? Somebody who writes divorces. Somebody needs a divorce. Though appointment of a substitute is preferable. A physician or a surgeon should engage a substitute for the Shiva period. In an emergency, however, or if the patient insists upon having his or her own doctor in attendance, the physician or surgeon should do what is necessary for the good of the patient. 9. A rabbi in mourning may answer halacha questions if he is the most qualified to do so. On these grounds, he may also perform a private wedding ceremony in his home, without instrumental music. Okay. So you can see that there's a fair amount of latitude, even though it comes on strong to begin with, you do, in reality, have a fair amount of latitude with the obligation to do the work.
Were these for bereaved others and parents, or these were, is this conference for parents and others?
In fact, it's for everybody, including the parents.
Is this kind of ritual sale of the business common practice?
No. No, it's only, you only get things like that where you can get them. Then they were the law so unclear. And the custom goes in one direction. As soon as you begin to incur financial loss, custom is compromised.
Okay.
Otherwise, that covers.
Yeah, I didn't know it was very typical in the Haredi community, for instance, that there's some mechanism by which a friend simply becomes legal owner.
For a practical reason, I honestly don't know that. I don't know how this actually happens in the community.
You mentioned instrumental music. You just mentioned.
Yes.
Instrumental
music. Right.
What do you mean?
The relevance of that was if you're the rabbi, you can, if there's a wedding that has to take place, you can officiate at the wedding as long as there's no instrumental music. Because music will change the nature of it. When you are the rabbi, you are misadir kiddushin, you are seeing to it that a wedding is performed according to the law. And since that's a reasonable thing to do, and somebody has to do it, and you may be the only one who is able to do it, then you're allowed to do it. But it doesn't mean that you have to be there while there are the kinds of entertainments which are otherwise appropriate at a wedding.
We just learned that the parents, the deceased parents, are put into a separate category than the other mourners. What about the children if you lose a child?
In the Talmud, the children are never considered to be in the same category. Remember, the major reason is because the death of children was not unusual. Okay, our sins is a very modern, and so very modern, I would say it's about 100 years old. 100 years at the most. In our religion, 100 years, nobody ever studies anything in the last 100 years. This can't be any good. I remember when I was a student for the late Professor Saul Lieberman, and Lieberman used to say, anything after the French Revolution, the New York Times. So that's a fairly Talmudic approach to it. Okay. All right, let's go on. Oh, this is interesting. Al kol hametim kulam. Ratza choletz, ratza eno choletz. Al aviv v'alimo choletz. Let's try to figure out what it's saying, first of all. If I were just reading this, I would understand it completely differently than the way the commentators explain it. For all of his deceased, other than the father and mother, if a person wants to, Ratza choletz. How do you translate the word choletz? Here it says, he bears the shoulder. Bears the shoulder.
Whether you use the word choletz,
nothing to do with shoes.
Wouldn't your first reaction be it probably means taking off shoes? That would be my reaction. My reaction would be that it probably would refer to taking off the shoes. Because in the Talmud itself, that action is called chalitza. Chalitza is from the Torah. And the chalitza involves taking off the shoe. So I would have thought it means taking off the shoe. That's not what the commentators say. The commentators indeed say what this commentary says, that it means bearing the shoulder. Bearing the shoulder. Now, we wonder what it could mean to bear the shoulder. Okay? Alaviv alimo choletz. But for a father and a mother, you must bear the shoulder. You must bear the shoulder. So, in all likelihood, this is referring to something involving kriya, the rending of the garment. And maybe, let's at least raise the possibility, maybe it has to do with the extent of the cut that you make. Okay? If you cut it really deep, or just think, look at what I'm wearing now. In fact, in order to see my shoulder, you would have to cut through a whole bunch of things. I'm wearing a jacket, I'm wearing a shirt, I'm wearing something under the shirt, I'm wearing an undershirt, I have a whole bunch of things there. Okay? So, maybe this is saying now that for the death of most people, when you are required to rid, you are required to rid partially. For others, you are, for the mother and the father, you are required to rid more completely. Something like that, to actually bear that particular part. Now here I want to read to you the way the Rambam understands this. The Maimonides, in his Laws of Living, chapter 8, Alaha number 3, summarizes this particular section of the Talmud. He writes as follows. Kol Shivat Yimei Avelut. Throughout the 7 days of mourning, Hakera Lifnim. Probably that means the rend in the garment faces forward. Faces forward. In other words, and you're used to this. If you visit a mourner and you look at the mourner, you expect to see a rend on the garment. And here, keep in mind, we're not talking about a rend of a ribbon. We're talking about a rend of a garment, because that's what the Talmud is referring to. Right? So probably what the Rambam means is during the 7 days of mourning, the rend is forward. The in ba lahachlif machlif. I guess this means probably if he changes his clothes, let's say that particular piece of clothing gets soiled. Machlif, you can change it. The eno korea kara acher. According to the Maimonides now, you do not rend the new garment as well. Shokol kera she'eno bisha'at chimum. Interesting term. Any rend that is not at the moment of literally heat, in other words, that isn't connected with the actual anguish, passion that is involved in the rending, the original rending itself, can't be done pro forma. Has to be done in the heat of feeling, as it were. Eino kera. So you can't just do another one afterwards. Very common, for example, people throughout my years in the rabbinate, particularly my previous congregation, it was rare, and it was true years ago, things are changing a lot today, for the better. Years ago, it was new universal to always have ribbons. Really universal. And today, more and more people will rend a garment. And it was always interesting. Lamb writes about it in his book. He said, the more financially secure the Jews were, the less they were willing to tear their clothes. Which is true. The more you have, the more the dearer it is to you. It was a weird thing, but it's true. It's very true. Okay. Bame devarim amurim. What are we talking about here? What is the situation? Bisha'ara metim chutz me'aviv imo. With the other deceased, excluding the father and mother. Aval al aviv ha'alimaho. But regarding the father and the mother, Korea Anchemigale et Libo. Okay? He makes the rend until you can see literally his heart. Probably means his skin. Okay? So I think that's the way the Rambam is interpreting the choletzir. That's the Rambam's interpretation of cholet. That you make a rend until the skin becomes visible. Umavdil spata beget. You make a separation in the, how do you say, the spata beget is the hem of, you know, if you would say hem, even, let's say, anything that, seam, maybe. Could be a seam. Eino korea bichli. One should not do this, the rend itself with an object. Elabiado, but with his hand. Mimachutz, bifnei kol ha'am. It should be done by the hand. And what we do is largely that. What we usually do is take a knife, you begin it, and then you say to somebody, tear with your hands. Actually do the tear with your hands. And that's the way it's actually done.
Does the mourner tear his garment?
Correct. The mourner tears his own garment. The mourner tears his own garment. And that is a very literal sense of the rending of garments that you have in the Bible. That's the sense of grief. As I say to people, how you feel outside is being expressed, how you feel inside is being expressed on the outside. You feel torn, you tear. It's interesting. Any of you here the other night for that?
Yes. Mary was also.
And you're here too. Have you heard Sam Claxton's comment on the other night, which was not directly, it didn't come out of any of this material, but Sam made a point of saying, speaking about the psychological power of rending the garment. That from a psychiatrist's perspective, he felt that that was one of the most cathartic of all moments. I don't think he used that term, but it was a powerful moment of dealing with the distress of being a mourner. And tearing the garment was just the most amazing and wonderful thing to be able to do in a circumstance like that. So that, I think, in a lot of these readings, is what is being referred to here. Okay? Any questions or comments? We're going to see this again a little bit later, and you'll see that it has some interesting ramifications as far as halacha goes, because if you think about what we just read, you kind of wonder what that means. Do you really, you know, walk around bare-chested? I mean, is that what it seems to be? Well, Maimonides is reading it as the law out of this Braita. Remember, this Braita is a little bit odd. The Braita itself, it's hard to understand. I'm not sure where the interpretations are right. And only if it's further developed in a certain direction will it in fact go in that direction, as you will see later.
Are shoes discussed in another section?
Yes.
That's why we know that this doesn't mean shoes.
No, I don't see why. Because tearing is also discussed in another section. Right, this is not the section to discuss tearing, and yet here it comes up in the Braita.
So there's a specific statement that this is all true for men and women, or is it just assumed that it's true?
It's assumed because of everything else that we've had. Of course, it makes it clear it's father and mother are dealt with as the same. So that's men and women. And it's true throughout all these discussions. We know who the relatives are that you must mourn for. They include women as they include men. And that's from the Torah. That's from the Torah.
The mourner? I meant the mourner.
Oh, that's a good point. I see what you're saying. That's a good point. Because let's say what I just read to you, Maimonides, would that apply to a woman? Where it says to uncover to the skin. I mean, I'm sure you sense in a society that puts a real premium on modesty, is that that seems odd. And in fact, the law is different for women. The law is different for women, as you'll see.
The mending the chumum is registered, so if you fail to do it with proper passion, it's not according
no.
to...
No. If you fail to do it, then you have to do it later. But if you've done it then, and you change your garment, you can't do it to the other garment. That's my mother. That's what my mother is saying. Other commentators say the opposite. They say that you have to do it, and if you take another garment, you have to tear that garment also.
And it has to be done in public?
That's also interesting. The answer is yes. It has to be done in public. But the question is, what is the public? What is the public? What constitutes the public here? Usually in the law, public is constituted by a minyan. And in Maimonides, the public nature of this is a crucial aspect of the whole thing. I would say I've seen that rarely done in public. But if it is done, there's a smaller public. It's usually done together with all the mourners. So sometimes it's few people, but very frequently it's more than that. But you can't do it privately. And let's say you were doing it just yourself. That would be the difference. You can't go into a room and do it just by yourself. way, it's a public expression of grief.
Do you have any personal experience that backs up what Sam said about the...
Oh, it's definitely true. Absolutely true. Absolutely right. See it again and again. Very, very frequently you'll see it's one of those moments that people will let go. And you sort of hope that it happened because there's a time to mourn. And if you don't mourn when you should mourn, it's much more difficult to deal with these things at other times. So, as we say from the Book of Kohelet, there's a time to mourn, there really is. And that frequently will help the process. Okay, let's keep going here. Okay, Rotzecho Leid, so to Eino Choleid. Allah, Vivi Abal, Valimo Choleid. Okay, with the mother and the father you have to. Uma chadigadola dor echad shemet aviv ubikesh lachalos. Once upon a time it happened with one of the gadolei ador, one of the great people of the generation, whose father died, and he wanted to bear himself in this way. Excuse me. Ubikesh gadol hador acher sheimo lachlots, and another gadol hador who was with him wanted to bear himself similarly. Now this goes back to another law which I don't think we've seen yet, which is that there is a rending of garments also for certain people who are public people. The gadol hador. Those who are the simple figures in a nation's life, or maybe an individual's central teacher, there are certain acts of mourning that are appropriate for at least some people in the public. And for certain leaders, the entire public. The entire public, as you'll see later on. So here, this gadol hador, his father died, and he wanted to do what was appropriate, and somebody else wanted to do it sympathetically with him, because he was his teacher. Nidina, the first person, decided not to do it, the lochalas, and he didn't bear himself. Why? Because he didn't want to put the other person in the position of having to do that. So obviously, you learn from a story like this that the whole activity is somewhat discretionary, and that the possibility of compromising somebody's, I don't know if it's well-being or their personal integrity, maybe embarrassing them because of the showing of flesh, then that's something that you really can and should have concern for. Okay? Now look down here at number 3 in the English. Well, let's look at 2 also, because Rashi gives a somewhat different explanation of this. Rashi, after rending his garment, the mourner slides his hand through the rent portion, exposing his shoulder and his arm. Right, that's not what I was describing. That's not what Maimonides described. I was taking refuge in Maimonides. Talmid Rabbi Yechiel mi Paris explains that he rents his clothes, should be rends his clothes, until his shoulder is bared. That's along the lines of what I was saying. Okay? He keeps his shoulder bared while following the bier until the deceased is buried. Now, maybe this was the Parisian custom at that particular time, post-Rashi. Okay? The fellows from Paris. Go on. Some explain this to mean that he bears both shoulders as one does in the case of the Nasi, the Gemara below. Others, however, expect that he bears only one children in the case of a parent. Re, that's Rabbi Yitzchak, who is one of the students, the generation of students after Rashi. Okay, we're dealing with a Frenchman in the early 12th century. Re is at a loss to explain why the mourner's practice of bearing the shoulder has fallen into disuse. So obviously by the beginning of the 12th century, in France, this wasn't done anymore, at least as understood here. Right? Where, as Rashi describes it, you actually put your arm through the hole and you fully bear the shoulder. Okay? That had fallen into disuse. Some explain that it is because nowadays most Jews live among non-Jews who would ridicule this practice. An interesting reason to change a practice. In fact, we see that every once in a while. We saw that as one of the reasons for the turning over the bed. Why that went out of practice, some of the commentators said, because we live among Gentiles, including people who work in our homes, and they would ridicule us if we turned over our beds. Okay, this is another example of that. Okay,
so cold.
Excuse me.
Cold in French.
It's also cold. You're right.
I think the last sentence of the footnote is really critical. There.
Yeah.
The dishonor of the dead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't finish it. And such ridicule would constitute a dishonor to the deceased. Correct.
So it's not just that, you know, we're backing away from.
Correct. In fact, any ridiculing of our mourning procedures ends up being a ridicule of the deceased. That's true. Okay. Take a look at note number 4. Rabbi Yechiel deduces from this incident that the practice of bearing the shoulder can be neglected where it would result in someone's dishonor. Okay? We have basically said that before. Okay. A little bit further. So he decides not to do it. Amar Abaya, Gadol Ador Rebbe. When we are talking about the person who was the great person of the generation, that's referring to Rebbe. Rebbe is Rabbi Judah the Prince, the editor of the Mishnah. Gadol Ador Sheimo, Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha. The Gadol Ador, who was with him, that refers to Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha. And then it's interesting, the Gemara says, the Ik of the Amre, there are those who say, Gadol Ador Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha. There are those who say that the great person of the generation was Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha. Gadol Ador She'imo, Rebbe. And the great person of the generation who was with him is Rebbe. Okay, now the Gemara comes and raises problems. Bishlam lemandimar gadol ador she'imahu Rebbe. It makes sense in the second version now, where Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha was the one who had lost the parent, and the gadol ador who was with him was Rebbe. That makes sense. I'll explain why. Haynu the Nimna v'lo chalatz. This first one, namely Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha, decided that he didn't want to put Rebbe into the position of having to bear his shoulder. But the one who says that Rabbi Yaakov Bar Acha was the person who was with him, not the one who was with him, and Rebbe was the one who suffered the loss, Amai Nimna V'lo Chalatz. How could he refrain from bearing the shoulder? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the Siava. The father of Rebbe was Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the Nasi. The Nasi was the leader of the Jewish community. When the leader of the Jewish community dies, everybody has to bear the shoulder.
Both shoulders.
Okay? Or both shoulders. Yeah, both shoulders, as the Gemara says. Exactly. Everybody has to do it. So it had nothing to, so if Rebbe doesn't do it, it makes no difference. It's, it doesn't depend upon what Rebbe does, because this is a universally obligated activity. Okay? The kuli alma v'chayvim l'michlas. Everybody has the obligation to bear the shoulder. To which the Gemara answers, Kashya. This is a difficult So basically I think that the Gemara, in a sense, rejects one of the two ikadiabres. There are those who say, one of them just doesn't make logical sense, and therefore in fact is to be rejected. Okay. Questions? We're going a little bit long. I can't go on too much longer. I'm going to lose it. I hope you'll understand. Al kol hametim kulam mistaper liachar shloshim yom. For all of the deceased, one gets a haircut after 30 days. Al aviv imo ad shigaru bo. Until one's suffers, I would call it, until one suffers social reproach. Okay? So in other words, when you're mourning for a father or a mother, you, even after the shoshin goes by, you can't get a haircut. And getting a haircut also means not shaving. The same thing. The same thing. So, but there's a limit to that. Hachiyigarubo.
It's going to take me a lot less than 30 days to earn that reproach.
To earn that reproach.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay. Okay. Well, if it's not for the father and the mother, it's okay.
Okay.
But if it is for the father and the mother, then you have to wait at least 30 days. Okay? Then after that point, you wait until there is reproach, social reproach. It's usually... You don't have a wife to tell you that. Your wives usually take care of that. Okay. I'll call him 18 kula nichnas lebeta simcha liachar shloshim yom. For all of the deceased, one can enter into beta simcha.
And how is place?
Beta simcha means a happy place.
What
a joyous place.
Place of entertainment.
Place of entertainment. Okay.
Else.
Well, house of pleasure, I'm not sure. It's going in a slightly different direction. I think you might have said, you know, what is a place of simcha? Maybe it means, in the Talmud, simcha is often connected with mitzvah. Simcha shal mitzvah.
A wedding, for example.
A wedding. Many of the commentators read this to mean a wedding, a brit milah. Okay? These are times when there is an obligation to express joy. Okay?
But brit milah, you don't have instrument, musical instrument, so...
That's correct. So there may be a difference between the brit milah and the wedding. There's also a difference in the concept behind the wedding. When you say... In the Sheva Brachot of a wedding, one of the things you say, Shahasimcha bin Ono, for joy is in his dwelling place. Okay? So you actually have blessings that speak of joyfulness in connection with the festive occasion itself. And the commentators say that in a Brit Milah, there's simply no such liturgy to begin with. Number two, in a Brit Milah, there's also a certain base level of anxiety. And therefore, there's anxiety in a Brit Milah. Now, you could argue there's anxiety in this one, too. That's also true. But it's not exactly the same. It's not the same. It's dealt with halachically differently. Okay? Okay, so let's go on here. I'll call him because I'm Nichnasa Beta Simcha, the Achar Shloshim Yom. So, generally speaking, for most of the mourning that one does, one can go into the Bet Simcha after 30 days. Al Aviv V'Alimo, the Achar Shnei Masachodesh. That's crucial. That's very important. But for the father and the mother, not until 12 months are finished. And here I think we've seen for the first time the mention of the 12 months, Yud Bet Chodesh. And that is another piece of the morning picture. When we say that there are stages of mourning, there is Shiva, there is Shloshim, and there is Yud Bet Chodesh.
Is this really the first time?
I think this is the first time we've run into it. I think it's the first time we've run into it, if I'm not mistaken. May have seen it in relation to cutting the hair, but I don't think so.
No, it wasn't though.
I think it's the first time we've seen it.
How long did Jacob mourn for Joseph?
How long did Jacob mourn for Joseph? Not at all. Because Joseph mourned for Jacob.
No, but when he told him that he died.
He told him that he was mourned by a wild beast.
Oh, that? I don't know, but in a way it doesn't matter either. You know why?
It's not for your children.
It's before Sunday. Before Mount Sinai. Okay? The stories of the Torah are very nice. But doesn't make, you can't make law out of that. Okay? Law comes from what happens at Sinai and post-Sinai. Okay? That's where the revelation takes place. So we can see these customs, but it's limited what you can learn from them.
Okay?
But even, I said this the other night, the laws of Shiva, it does say that Joseph mourned for Jacob 7 days. So some do relate the laws of Shiva to that. Only problem is that the story of Joseph can't be a source of halacha. This is precise. Exactly, because it's an Egyptian custom. Exactly. How do you know the difference?
Nadav and Abihu died before the Torah?
After.
After it was?
Oh, sure. And they died with the institution, the beginning of the sacrificial system. The sacrificial system is after the revelation of Mount Sinai. Okay. So, Alaviva Alimo Yechashem Asachodesh. Amar Rabba Babar Chana. Says Rabbi Babar Chana, Ulesimchat Nereut. Now, this is a very difficult sentence here in the comments, in the Gemara, because it says literally Ulesimchat Nereut, and for the joy of friendship. So, what in the world does that mean? So. It could mean, well, let's just look at some of the commentaries here to see the way in which this is interpreted. Here, the English itself, as it reads it, and that which the Baraita permits a mourner for someone other than his parent to enter a house of celebration after 30 days refers specifically to a celebration of friendship. Okay? But he may not attend a truly joyous event. So in other words, if after 30 days, not for the parents, other people, okay? If after 30 days there is a friends get together, and so there's no music, okay? And they're just having dinner together, okay? That is okay after 30 days. However, a joyful occasion with music is not even good after 30 days. And that would then apply that for the parent, even the simchat v'reyut, even the friendship party, is not good for 12 months. Okay? That's the problem with this. We've got to interpret it that way. Because you could just as easily interpret this, since we don't know what this is connected with, maybe this is referring instead to, well, let's see what, where is it? I have a comment here, number 10. Let's look at number 10. Other Rishonim, however, explain that the reverse is meant. Okay? It is only a friendship celebration that is forbidden. But a true mitzvah celebration, such as a wedding, may be attended immediately because of the mitzvah involved. Okay.
But you weren't supposed to spoil it for the. I thought you weren't supposed to draw.
Let's say it's you're in Shloshim, and there's a Brit Milah. Can you go to a Brit Milah? That'd be the question here. Okay. Maybe the answer is yes. Maybe the answer is his latter opinion is that the answer would be yes. Nevertheless, the answer would be yes. Okay? So it's a difficult piece of, but just that one additional phrase, L'simchat Mereyut, creates all kinds of problems.
Sure.
And it creates problems even to this day. But I'll get to that either tonight or next time. Just wanted to show you in the Tosafot. Over in the Tosafot, I want to look at another Tosafot before that. Tosafot now is on the right side of the Hebrew text, right side of the Gemara text. And there, the second Tosafot is Adshi Garubo. Until they rebuke him. And the Tosafot point out one thing here which I think is just good to have jogged in your memory. Nireh deregel eino mevatel davar zeh. It then is reasonable to assume that the presence of a regel, of a holiday, does not cancel this thing. That's what I wanted to point out to you. Remember, we said that if you have a holiday, it cancels Shiva. Mm-hmm. If you have a holiday, it cancels Shloshim. Okay? You might have thought that as far as the year-long traditions go, or at least one or more of those traditions, there aren't a lot of them, that the regel also, a holiday would also have some impact on the observance of this. Right? You might have thought. Of course, if you think about it, it couldn't be, because you can't have a year that doesn't have holidays, right? So if it were to cancel, then you'd never be able to have a year's observance of any of these, or at least of whatever you define as being cut off by the regel. So the Tosafot is simply pointing out here that you might have thought that the shaving, for example, or cutting the hair, is limited by the holiday would cut it off. But what we learned from this is obviously that that's not true. Right? Next, ulesimchat mereut. Next Tosafot. The joy of friends. Perash bekuntres. Rashi understood. Kuntres means Rashi. Kuntres literally means, how would we say it? You lawyers would say briefs. Notebooks. The notebook. It's explained in the notebook, meaning Rashi, Sudot Shosim Re'im Va'ahuvim Zelazeh. Right? These are meals that friends make for one another. Re'im Va'ahuvim. People who are friends and love is probably too strong.
Let's go
through
the
days. Enjoy social occasions.
The kach mi red the dafka l'simchat reyut mutar liachar shloshim yom, and it appears that what this means is dafka, that it is this kind of thing that becomes permissible after 30 days. Right? It's only that, and if it were something else that involved that same music, then it would not be permissible after 30 days. If you go down to the Rashi. Oh, about halfway down in this Tosafot. Toward the end of the line it says, the yud, and the two slashes are the mem. You can see there are some brackets, bet, on the line above. V'yesh mefarshim l'simchat mereut mutar likames li'alter. There are those who interpret the simcha of friends that it is permissible to begin that immediately. Right? For those who are observing the Shloshim. And it's for those who are observing mourning for other than the parents. The Adam Mesudat Chatan Ayridan. and we apply it even to the veil of a chatan. Surat chatan. I'm not sure exactly what that's referring to, because I doubt it's referring to a wedding. I think it's referring to a joyful meal, probably before the wedding actually happens. And so on. Ima ya suda shel mitzvah mutar. Here, the Yerushalmi has an additional qualification that if the meal was a mitzvah meal, it is mutar. It is permissible to take part in it. Lo yadana mahu kore sudat mitzvah. And then the Tosafot say, I don't know exactly what you mean by mitzvah meal. Which meal is a mitzvah meal? Okay? Well, that's open to interpretation. So, the truth is that as far as the law goes, this is a very, very difficult and complicated area of law. There are really very few customs that extend for an entire year. You mentioned this. The cutting of hair, to some extent, for the parent, also the wearing of new clothes. And that, too, is really terminated by some situation of rebuke. Namely, you run out of your own clothes. Once you run out of your own clothes, then we allow you to go beyond it. Right? You just don't go out and buy new clothes, but if you need them, you can. That's enough of a cause to go beyond that. The real thing is what constitutes a happy occasion. Which are the permissible happy occasions and which are the prohibited happy occasions? You read in Rabbi Lamb's book, for example, goes in two opposite directions. He says that there are those who say that a sudat mitzvah is dafka the happy occasion that's prohibited. That's to say, the thing you're not allowed to do is to go to a wedding. Why? Because that's where you're really happy. You say other things are not as happy. And what we are really interested in doing is keeping you away from a surah that's particularly happy. The other side is you can't go to a surah unless it's a surah mitzvah. Unless it is an occasion which is for a mitzvah. But you would say that that's too happy. No, that's not the issue. The issue is that it's a mitzvah. And because of the fact that it is a mitzvah, we allow you to do that. And we're not trying to keep you away from the mitzvah. Okay? So that's why it's very complicated if you ever want to pursue this. You need to pursue that. What to do as far as weddings go. There are all kinds of points of view as far as weddings go. This is often the lack of clarity here in the text. Right? Whenever lawyers don't write clearly, suffer for thousands of years. Just take that seriously, wherever you are. I don't know.
Is there any consensus, though, that nowadays the way weddings are organized, is there any consensus as to the permissibility of, is there clearly a bifurcation between the ceremony and then the policy reception afterwards? So in other words, is it pretty much
some say yes. Some say yes. And it goes along exactly the same line. Some say, well, surely if there's music afterwards, you can't go to that.
That's no, right. I
mean, so the question is whether you can go to a ceremony. Some would say, yes, you can go to a ceremony. Others would say, well, the ceremony is really the happy part. That's the real simcha is the ceremony itself. It says, Hasimcha b'ma'ono, first festival for the ceremony. I would say most common practice is that you do go to a ceremony. People do go to ceremonies, and frequently people will leave after a ceremony. Sometimes people just, it gets uncomfortable also, they'll leave here in a circumstance like that. Sometimes people just avoid it altogether. That happens as well.
Is there any part of the not going to a sutta because you don't want to put a damper on it for the other people who are there?
That's
not a part of it?
No. That's not a part of it. The assumption is that That's not the problem. The problem is you as the mourner. We're not worried about the other people. We're worried about you. Okay.
Would people cancel a wedding?
Depends on the
circumstance. That the grandfather died. The daughter's daughter is getting married. Shortly thereafter. Right.
In most cases, in our society, most cases you don't allow to cancel.
You'll never get that location again.
It's all part of this. Don't think that this doesn't enter into the law. The fact is that, as you saw before, significant financial loss is all part of the considerations here. So that the law will rarely push you into position where, number one, you'll suffer that kind of a loss. Number two, there's a real balancing act that goes on between the importance of a wedding and mourning. Those two are sometimes balanced off against each other, and in certain circumstances it's clear the wedding wins. You have a funeral procession and a wedding procession. Wedding procession goes first. The wedding is more important than the funeral.
Okay.
On that point,
Thank you.